So, welcome to Germany in the 20th century. We're all in the right place. And what I'm going to do first is go right to where maybe 10 or 20% of you want us to go anyway, and talk to you a little bit about the Nazis, and talk to you a little bit about Nazi propaganda and Nazi film and Nazi culture. We'll get that out of our system, and then we can talk about Germany more broadly, and try to keep from seeing everything as leading to and leading from the Nazis, which is a tendency to telescope things that way. But we'll give ourselves our dose of that as a way of thinking about how history can be approached, not just through a series of dates and events and names and statistics, which are all fine, not that there's anything wrong with that, right? But through records that are contained in the cultural products of men and women who've attempted to capture in the arts, literature, film, music, not just what happened, but some sensibility about what happened, some emotional responses, feelings about what took place. And I think at its most important level, this is what cultural and intellectual history tries to do. Yes, in this class, you will get a general framework of what happened in Germany. Things happen, one damn thing after another, as Winston Churchill says. And that's good. We need that framework. But you'll forget that as soon as you finish your exams and go on somewhere else, and you'll need to remember what those dates were and those names were, and you can watch the History Channel to do that, or you can go on Wikipedia and check up on it, and so on and so forth. But within that, I would like for you to get a feeling for the experience of these periods. And to do that, I want to turn to these voices that come through in cultural sources, in the arts. And I think then you'll have a much more personal touch point with the experience of whatever field you happen to be studying, but in this case, 20th century German development and the major events of that time. So we'll set that framework forth, but then we'll engage with documents such as this film. Now, this film has a kind of special place in all of this. It was commissioned by the Nazis, and it was produced by a woman named Leni Riefenstahl. Some of you may know her story. It's more notorious than famous, or infamous rather than celebrated, because of that background. Not that just that Leni Riefenstahl did it, but that it was commissioned by the Nazis, and she did it favorably. The film actually won an International Film Festival Award at Paris, which was the film festival at the time. I'm not sure which category it won in, but it was definitely perceived in the international community as a rather innocuous record of what was going on in Germany, which may seem strange to you now. But and we can't really see it in that kind of a neutral way. But I think from it we can get a sense, certainly, of what, and this is her problem, Leni Riefenstahl felt about the National Socialist movement, but also that the impact that it had on the imaginations and the spirit of those people who partook in and watched these events. And I want to give you a sense of how cultural historians use a source like this to weave together an emotional comprehension of what was going on. How, in this case, the National Socialists and Leni Riefenstahl herself incorporated, you know, all the elements of modern German history, really, going back to the 18th century, to create symbols that would impact Germans and give them a feeling that this new state, this new order that was coming, was going to provide them things that they really felt were lacking. And to a certain extent, this course will telescope and try to show you what it was that Germans felt were lacking and why this would have had such appeal. But it operates at this symbolic level, at this aesthetic level, and has actually inspired some historians to think of National Socialism as having been not just some sort of political movement led by some sort of mesmerizing or even hypnotic leaders, but as a secular religion, as a source of many of the things that traditional religion had provided in a secular age. And this explains the connection that people felt with this culture, not just movement, but this culture, at a time when traditional religions were providing those things and things seemed to be falling apart and as disruptive as they could be within German society. Right. So, I was just going to start by starting it, but I see a few familiar faces here, and you know I can't resist setting the stage. Let's watch a few scenes, a few minutes of this, to get a feeling for a cultural historical approach to a document like this. This thing is so rich with stuff for taking this approach. I mean, it starts right with the credit lines or the titles. I have to gauge a little bit and maybe skim a little ahead. What you have, first of all, you have this this title, The Triumph of the Will. Okay, The Triumph of the Will. Who might they have been referring to? Whose ideas might they have been referring to in invoking such a title? Okay, yes, it is his will that's triumphing, right? But thinking in a broader sense, who's he attaching himself to? Well, the folk, yeah, that it is the folk's will as well. We're getting there. He the first Kaiser Wilhelm was the Kaiser when this person was writing. But who writes about will and willpower? Nietzsche, right? So there's this cultural pretension there. This is the triumph of that thing, this German will. Right? What manifested in the people and das Volk and Hitler's own actions and so on, but they're by using that word, right, that has a resonance that goes to the highest cultural level, giving them a sense of legitimacy, right there. Okay, I'm going to skim ahead a little bit. On 5th of September, 1934, right? 20 years after the outbreak of the First World War, okay? So they're setting the stage, Leni Riefenstahl, 16 years after the beginning of German suffering. That's the revolution of 1918 and the establishment of the Weimar Republic, right? 19 months after the beginning of the German Renaissance, okay? That's the 19. So this is just 19 months into the Third Reich. Okay. Adolf Hitler flew again to Nuremberg to review the columns of his faithful followers. Oh yeah, it's easier to translate when you read the subtitles. Okay, so there are some touch points there. The First World War, right? The revolution at the outbreak of revolution that overtook the monarchy after the war, and the republican system that was established after that. So you need to understand this document to have a sense of that, right, of those things, of what those things represented. And they're not just events, they're symbols. That First World War, as we're going to see, it just means everything at that time. Hitler was a First World War veteran. You've got to remember that. His self-image is of two things, an artist and a veteran of the trenches. So the First World War is central there. Right? And then the Weimar Republic and all of its problems. It's a symbol of decadence, modernism, decline, immorality, all of these things. That's what the collapse they're talking about means. Right? So those are really loaded things. So then we go into this. Up in the clouds, right? How romantic can it be? Right? You're literally coming out of the sky with Hitler, right, in this plane. And what are you coming down onto? This imperfectly intact medieval to 16th century city of Nuremberg, right? Which is now was flattened in the war. Right? So everything you're seeing here was destroyed in the war. But it was one of the most beautiful cities in Central Europe, without question. Right? And you can see that. Now, musically, what's happened is you've gone from this very Wagnerian music, and that's been transposed over into the Nazi anthem. So you have that whole romantic thing with the clouds, and then you come down into this medieval world, and this medieval world is the world of the Nazi movement, and here they are marching in for the rally. They're coming in as well as Hitler does. So you have the whole romantic background of clouds, spirit, nature, connection with all of that stuff, and Hitler comes from on high and down into that, right? And is going to bring that, let me pause that. I want to finish that point, because it's really key. It's going to, you know, he's going to reconnect Germans in the 30s, right? Remember, 1934. Right, 1934, we're, you know, there's baseball going on, there's a depression, yes, but, you know, we're starting to, this is not that long ago. Life is like, pretty much like the life you know, pretty much. I don't, you know, if any of you watched the Ken Burns special on the war and so on, you really get a sense. I mean, this isn't that long ago. These people think the same way that most of us do and so on and so forth. I think it may have been a little more clear cut for them than they are for us, but they didn't have iPods and so forth, right? So, but they invoke this whole notion of the medieval and the spiritual and so on. But not just that. Look what he's coming in on. Right? He's coming in this plane, the modern. Right? It's oversimplification to say the Nazis were just hearkening unto the traditional. If they'd done that, then they wouldn't have had a modern military to be able to invade Czechoslovakia and invade Poland and stave off the rest of the world for 4 years, right? They had to have the technology too, right? So there's a paradox there. Wait a minute, the Nazis are supposed to be all about the medieval and reviving all of that stuff. That's one part of their appeal, right? But then there's Hitler coming in on airplanes and highlighting that. And actually in 1930 through 1933, I'd have to check the dates, but when he's actually campaigning in elections, he was flying around, and it was something that the Völkische Beobachter, the main newspaper, highlighted. Hitler, the flying tour. He's part of this modern world. He's technologically savvy, right? He's connected to that energy of the modern as well, right? So see, they've got you on both ends. They've got you in this, oh, I really wish we could go back to the medieval, and, you know, we need to have a modern, powerful economy and have weapons and move forward as well. So see how those symbols work both ways, right? And here he comes. Now, actually, you know, the record is that he didn't like to fly personally, but he flew a lot, and that was part of this image building. Okay. So we're going to land. Skim ahead. We have a little crowd waiting for us. So get a little sense of that. Now let's skim ahead. Okay. And here come the. There he comes. Right. Okay. Goebbels. Riefenstahl's really good. Oh, there's the friendly Hitler himself. And she's really good at these shots where she'll show you that front row or first two rows, right? But she takes it at an angle that doesn't indicate that that's all there are there. It looks like a massive crowd along the way, but as you see them go by, it's really one or two rows thick. But she gives you sense that that folk is there, that that thick folk is there, right? And she loved this shot. This is her favorite shot in the movie, right there. The sun god, the giver of light, right? Tapping into a lot of Aryan folkish culture that we'll talk a little bit about, right? So she really loved, she had the camera right there in the back. And so you have that notion of the, you know, Apollo, the god of light, being brought in his carriage, right? So tapping into that whole neoclassical notion, right, of him bringing in. But look, how about that for a product placement? Did you see it? What was it? Mercedes, right? So he's in his car, and he did like his cars, and he liked riding around in his car, and that's also what, you know, was part of his image. That there are a lot of photographs with him with his little air helmet on, wet leather, in the car, right, in the early days. Because he had these very powerful Mercedes that he'd be chauffeured around once they had the money from corporations, including Mary. We won't go into that. I restrained myself a little bit. Well, Ford, once they went into power, Ford was one of the major advertisers in the National Socialist newspaper, by the way. Just a little. So it wasn't just Mercedes. But that's compared with all this medieval stuff. If you go into the city, and little children, every politician does that, right? So there's the connection with the kids, youth, right? They like Hitler too. Look at that. Right, so all of these just powerful symbols legitimizing this figure, but tying together these elements of German culture that really in an intricate way. I mean, the Riefenstahl is doing. Here's some of your tradition. Just the site itself, which they selected. I mean, they were based in Munich, but they would go up to Nuremberg for their rallies because of this environment. That fit so much with that traditionalist element, which was not the only one, as you know now. But here, all of these evocations of that traditional world that will be revived, but in a powerful way that was also consistent with the necessary aspects of modernization, but not in a modernist way, not with the problems of modernism. Right? That's what they're saying. We're going to have a kind of it's actually called Reactionary Modernism by one scholar, which is a good book by Jeffrey Hirsch. Okay, so see, I mean, you can go crazy. I could just go on and on and on and on and on, just breaking this stuff down. Every image is just full of stuff that taps into not what happened, but why it had appeal. I mean, the SS, that whole thing, we'll talk about that. But that here they are, and they're in the black, set apart from even the rest of the party. This is done in 1934, for those of you who are in the know, just weeks after the Night of the Long Knives, where the SS had killed off the leader of the SA, and they'd done an internal purge. Right? So this image of the SS was brand new, and they're really highlighting it. They are now in charge of the party itself, and they're... these soldiers, or they're not soldiers. These are not soldiers. These are not military men. That is party. That is as if you had a bodyguard around Barack Obama that looked like that, we'll just say. That's what that is. It's a party. It's not the army. You have to remember that the army's over here. This is the SS and the SA. Those are party uniforms. It has nothing to do with the military. Right? They are unofficial. They're only there to protect Hitler within the party. But he's tapped into, I'll give you a little SS stuff right there. They tapped into this tradition that goes back to Prussia, that goes back in the Prussian military, when Frederick the Great, Frederick II in the second half of the 18th century, had his bodyguard, and he picked guys who were tall. He thought it was really cool to have all these tall guys, right, like 6'5" and above. okay? And that was his bodyguard. I don't know, I think he was very tall, so he might have looked a little bit like a munchkin among them. I don't know, maybe he was tall. That, I shouldn't say that. But the Leibstandart, that's what that is. That's the bodyguard. Within the SS, the core of it is the Leibstandart, which is 25 guys who are his bodyguard, okay? And, you know, they're taller than everybody else, right? And they've, of course, got the skull and crossbones on and the black uniform and all of this stuff, which is, just sends shivers through the soul of a 13-year-old boy, okay? I mean, this is Darth Vader, right? I don't know all of them because I have daughters, okay? But, I mean, everything that a little boy would think is really cool, right? In a sick sort of way, that's what the SS did, right? Cool, really cool, and they knew how to manipulate that. Right? And believe me, that was that's part of it. So tall, black, death skull, standing there, perfectly chiseled. Yeah.
Were the Prussian bodyguards called Junkers?
The Junker are the aristocrats from the Prussian area, okay, right? And their sons would have been in the military. And they very well might have been part of the bodyguard, but that's a separate term that applies to this whole group of aristocrats in the Brandenburg area, which is where Prussia is, right, and Berlin and so forth. Good question. Okay, now let me skim ahead to another spot here. After hopefully giving you a sense of how you can break this stuff down. Okay. Now, there are a few different elements of the party rally are depicted here, or captured here. I'm going to go to one from which you've probably seen a number of images before. And that just so is it going to skip for me? There, good. No. Here. This is out at the airport. This is where they did their rally, these air strips. Now, what's happening here in this environment that is a colossal version of the kind of rally environment that Hitler had designed in the beer halls of Munich when he got started. Now, we're going to talk all about this, but Hitler was very aesthetically oriented. Okay, and he was really involved with the design of this stuff. Speer put it together, but Hitler has a lot to do with it. Now, what they've done, he and Himmler and the new leader of the SA, whose name I can't remember, have walked across this incredible expanse. Right? And what they just did is, did you catch it? Did you see those flames? Okay. Those are memorials, eternal flames for 23 Nazis who had been, I think, well, it happened in 23, so maybe it was 26, I'm not sure, but who had been killed in the beer hall putsch of 1923, okay? So here are the martyrs. These are the martyrs of the movement. There's the, you know, this incredible emotional connection that they're establishing, paying homage to those martyrs, right, who had not fallen in the effort to carry forth the movement. Now, here come individuals marching and carrying the standards of every subgroup within the Nazi Party. It's called Gau, a Gau term. That's what's the word? I don't even know what the word. This is for every little town or every little neighborhood, whatever your Nazi club is, okay? This is your standard is being carried in. Okay. Does anybody recognize where those standards come from in Western cultural history? What are they modeled on? Rome, right? It's right out of Rome. This exact sort of form is what the Romans would carry in front of their legions, okay? if you watch Rome, the series, you may see some in there. That was pretty good. So you see, this is representative of each and every Gao, each and every group within the party. And then comes what they call this formation. They call this the Sea of Flags. Is that? Now what you have to, and then in color, this is all red, white, and black. It's a sea of red. Look, I mean, is that cool? I mean, just it would send shivers through you if you were watching it. And what that's flowing through, this red river, is flowing through two banks of brown. Because these are the brown shirts. Their uniforms were brown. So you have this brown field out there, and then this flow of those red flags coming in. There's a sort of romantic, you know, inspiriting sort of thing. It's literally a river of blood flowing through them. Right? There are just so many emotional evocations that can trigger. Everybody's in place. Here go the flags, and they're going by all those brown shirts. They're the SA, the stormtroopers, okay? Which is what most of the party members are. They're members of the SA. But remember, whoop, that's where I wanted to be. Just before this, the SA, boom, oh, I want to go back. Let's see, I'm blowing the moment. So everybody's doing their thing with their, at least Lenny Riefenstahl has put this march music in the background. Blasmusik, they call it in German. Brass music. And then in come the SS. Okay, here come the SS. This is the real show, and this is a real symbol of they're now in charge. They just killed thousands of Nazi party members and a number of other enemies of the party. Okay? So this is Himmler walking in and saying, we're in charge now. Don't mess with us anymore. Right? And look at the difference. All brown, look at black. See the percentage? Right? See the percentage? That's SS within the party. They're like the MPs in the military. They're there to keep the party in control. Right? And this is the new SSR member who has this squeaky voice, and you kind of think you would be squeaking too, because his predecessor had just been murdered in bed with a bunch of boys out in a Bayerisch Hof in the mountains, had been murdered in his sleep. Okay, so focusing on the cultural, okay, the broader cultural things, these rallies were incredible combinations of a lot of things. They've gone on in German history since the 18th century. It's this concatenation, this intense combination of romantic references, which connect the individual with a sense of something bigger. You're lost in this modern world. You're alienated. You're out of work. You don't know where the nation's going. You don't know where your life is going. Well, you can feel like you're part of something bigger. Just as the Romantics had said at the beginning of the 19th century, when people felt like they didn't know where things were going, they were alienated, they didn't know where the nation was going, the Romantics at the beginning of the 19th century had said, well, think about nature, and think about something higher, and think about connecting yourself to love, and think about connecting yourself to something like the love of the nation. We need to invent something like that, and then the individual can subsume themselves into something bigger and really feel part of a larger whole. Okay, and images like rivers and flags and blood and rituals, right, provided that sense of an emotional content. Right? But just like that technology at the very beginning, it's framed within a very controlled environment and space. Right? Speer has laid this out in very geometrically precise ways. Think about those ranks and those rows of individuals. The contrast of the sea of flags against those ranks and rows as it comes in. So you're sitting there and you feel like you're in a stable, orderly universe that has very clean lines. okay, and leads up to the Führer and the hierarchy of the party, from which you will receive your orders very clearly, right, and you will know what to do in these very rational, logical ways, right? And you step into that environment, and it's nice, neat, orderly, balanced, stable, and so on and so forth, while the rest of the world looks totally chaotic. So you get both of those things. You get this emotional connection, right, and you get this sense of structure and order. This is the genius of Hitler and the cultural leaders of the Nazi movement, because they were able to combine those two things, and even though they're exclusive, create this paradoxical combination that worked. And you could highlight one at one point and another at another point, and you could cover their bases. Right? You could never. National Socialist German Workers' Party. That's what it stands for. So you have nationalism and you have socialism. German, workers, and then party. And you could, depending on who you were speaking to, you could emphasize any one of those things and cover a lot of bases that way. Right? So that's sort of a literary or a linguistic way that they were malleable. But in this grander scheme, there's this frame of romantic versus classical, and they incorporated both of these important 18th and 19th century traditions into their image, and that was very powerful. Now let me just show you one little bit here, and this may sell it. I hope it does. Okay, we have to get past this screen. There, he just made a quick reference to the. Oh, I shouldn't do that to you. I won't do that to you. Just a second. Where am I going to? One more part. This is 114. Okay, here it comes. Now, after he gives his speech, which you've just sped read, okay, there's going to be another ritual. And here's where I think it comes together in an intense way. And this is why it's something like this that explains why we talk about this as a secular religion. Hitler's walking along and he is grabbing the standards of new Gaue who are just entering into the party. So your neighborhood has a new group and they're being officially welcomed into the party. Now what he's doing there is really weird. Okay? Now just for a second. All right. He has his personal flag. All right. The bodyguard protected him and Hitler's personal flag, and that flag was carried on the day November 9, 1923. I know that because a lot of big things happened on November 9 in German history. November 9, 1923. They were going to try to seize power in Munich, get weapons, and then go up and march on Berlin. They were going to use Mussolini's model to take over power in Germany. Okay, so it was going to be a putsch, right? Not winning an election, which is what they end up doing, but it takes 10 years for that to happen after this. But they were going to seize power. Okay, so they went from a beer hall and they went across, and the general that was going to provide him with the arms reneged. Hitler had a conniption fit and said, "We're going to do it anyway. God damn it, we're going to do it anyway." So they did it anyway, and they marched into the main square of Munich, and there was a phalanx of police, and they shot them down. Okay, they stopped the march there. If they'd only been so tough all the way through, we wouldn't have to be talking about this garbage, right? But at least at that point, they were still standing up to them. Excuse me, I tried to clear my throat with a little tea, and I end up choking on it. Okay, so the martyrs down there, 26 of them, or however many there are, 16 of them, fell. Hitler ducked and covered, got the hell out of there, but one of them fell and bled on this flag. Okay, so this flag had blood on it from the martyrdom of these early followers. Okay? So it's called the blood flag, literally. It's the Blutfahne, the Blutfahne, and this thing only came out on special occasions, right? And that's Hitler's personal flag. And what he's doing is he has his, we actually know that this guard was interviewed later. He's his personal bodyguard. Within the SS Leibstandarte, he's his personal, he's a strange guy, still alive, at least in the 70s or whenever, when they did these extensive interviews with him. Totally unrepentant, of course. you won't get that one on Netflix, I don't think, but I saw it in Germany one day. Anyway, he's walking behind him with the flag over Hitler's shoulder, and Hitler has his flag in his hand. And what he's doing is he's walking along, and he's grabbing the standard of the new Gau, and he's touching his flag to it, and he's gripping the two of them together. Okay? And then, that's what he's doing right now. He's reaching and grabbing the standard of the new group, and he's going to stare into the eyes of the group leader. And that's the magical, mysterious moment when that individual and that representing that Gau are organically included. Boom. When Hitler stares him in the eye and touches the blood flag to you. It's a mystical thing. Right? Here's this religiosity drawn from the Baroque church. I mean, go back to relics, go back to the Middle Ages. I mean, it's crazy stuff. I mean, we're playing baseball over here and listening to, you know, the Carter family. And this is what they're doing. Okay? So watch this for a second. I think you'll see that this whole combination of ritual and romance and so on and so forth. What we have to figure out in this course is why that would seem so attractive. Why aren't they playing baseball and, you know, just listening to folk music for its own sake? Why are they attaching all this stuff to it in 1934 with Mercedes and planes flying around? Right? But that's what we won't be able to answer that tonight. Boom. He's in. Oop. That's a little of the impact there. Is that crazy or what? Because it's this, that ritual component to it. Right out of the, with it, and you've got neoclassicism with the standards, you've got the blood, you've got this spiritual thing, you've got the charismatic leader, I mean, it's all there. So this is just to give you an idea of how, you know, you need to go beyond just what's happening to get a feel for how it would have been attractive, or what they were using that took it beyond just the immediate, right? And then we can talk about why this stuff would have seemed attractive to Germans at this particular time, or to some Germans, to a significant minority of Germans. It's never a majority, you know, we have to acknowledge that. But all you need is a powerful minority and you get the levers of power and then you've got problems, okay? we want to get in there and look at these themes and get past just the surface. And we can do that by going into these cultural records, by looking at how images are manipulated in this case. Or in the case of other works that we'll look at, how other artists, writers, and so on are responding to things and coming up with the imagery, symbolism, and so on that can tell us about their emotional responses to things. You take that away, and it'll always be there for you. The dates you can look up, right? But a sense of, you know, this energy that's driving it, right? Or the impact that energy had on others, right? I think you can get that by taking this approach, which is what we'll do. Did you have a question or something? No? Okay. Sorry. You were just... no, I'm kidding. Bad joke. Really bad. I apologize.
I've never seen this movie before, but I get
A couple times.
How?
It goes with the territory. Okay. I'm actually I'm a European cultural and intellectual historian who picked Germany to write about, and so then, well, you know, whereas if you're going to get a book published, you better have a swastika on it. So, you know, you know, that's what Borders wants. So, you know, it goes with the turf. So it's not just an obsession on my part.
Intellectual montage. How much do you think this film technique plays into Riefenstahl's film?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it's all montage. I mean, absolutely. You know, Eisenstein is behind everything here. So, yes.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that later. Okay. No doubt about it. I mean, she's just juxtaposing these things in an incredible way, which is why she won the film festival and why you can't deny that it's a phenomenal, you know, product, even though it was, you know, in the interest of something that we certainly consider heinous. And her career never recovered from it after the war, of course. Right. But, you know, before we go too far into film theory, let's... syllabus that I asked you all to take a look at and even print out. Now there's some symbolism on this too, although it's a little bit cheesy, but it's not without some significance. Who can anyone identify these flags with me? Yeah. Okay. That's right. This is actually the Imperial War flag, which is cooler than the other one, which would be just black, white, and red, right? So that's the Imperial War flag, and it has the Prussian eagle on that and the Iron Cross, okay? So that's Wilhelmine. That's turn of the century in our course, in the 20th century, turn of the century, but really we'll say 1870 and 1871 until 1918, okay? How about this one? Right? And what would it have been the flag of first?
Weimar Republic.
Okay. Now, this goes back before the beginning of our course, but this was the flag of the progressive unification movement at the beginning of the 19th century. And in 1848, they're fighting for unification, but under democratic principles. And there are a number of revolts in the major cities of Germany following the revolts in Paris, some of you may know. But it's a quasi-socialist movement that doesn't turn because the bourgeois get what they want and then sort of say, well, that's enough. And then the police come in and it stops. So it's this turning point where things might have gone more socialist than capitalist and in the French history. And in Germany, they weren't that far along. They almost go to a democracy in 1848, but it just doesn't quite stick. The forces of reaction, the monarchies and the conservatives, wait it out. They argue too much, sort of proving the point of the anti-democrats that it's just a talk shop and they can't get anything done. They put together a beautiful constitution which had freedom for everybody and free speech and freedom of movement and freedom of speech and women's rights and all sorts of things. A wonderful document, but it fell apart. Okay, and then a lot of them ended up in Milwaukee and Chicago. That's not even a joke, because they had to get the hell out. And so you have this huge influx into this area, just down the street here in Old Town, of 1848ers. So you have this leftist German tradition in Milwaukee. Some of you may be socialists from Milwaukee in your tradition, I don't know. And anarchists in Chicago, right, leading to the Haymarket Square. So if any of you know that kind of thing, you know, this comes from 1848, and that's what that flag first represented. And then when they get rid of the empire or the monarchy in 1918, they use that flag again. Okay? Boom, right? That's another Germany. So we have Wilhelmine Germany, Weimar Germany, Nazi Germany. And then after the war, East Germany and West Germany, and of course this is now the flag of the whole Germany again. So you can see the sequence. And okay, isn't that cool? But the point here is that you just can't talk about the history of Germany You have to talk about the histories of these Germanies, even up to now. It's the German problem. Yeah, the German problem is they, you know, start world wars, right? But the reason that they start world wars, right, is that there's this very serious dilemma as to how you define what Germany is. It's not clear, okay? And it's not clear it's still not clear. There's still, I mean, we've pretty much resolved it. Okay, Germany is what it is. I don't think there's gonna be, what did it take to get it there, where it is now, okay? There are still some people who are over there in Silesia who really feel pissed off because Kohl said, all right, we won't take Silesia. We're not going to press for Silesia in the reunification. That was, you know, he made that deal with Gorbachev. So there are still some people who aren't fully satisfied with the way things panned out, okay? But that's residual, sort of a small thing that, you know, even outside of Germany you wouldn't know about probably, although it was a pretty big issue because they were a strong, they were like the Cubans' influence in Florida politics. Okay, and they really backed Kohl as a conservative for a long time. And then when Kohl saw the opportunity to unify, he said, sorry, Cubans, we're going to go. Okay, and we're not going to be able to get what you want. So thanks for all your money and all your support over these years, but we're going to go for this. And so there are probably still some people out there saying, this is not the Germany we wanted. This is not it. We don't have the whole thing yet, right? But let's take this back now, two centuries. There's no Germany. There's no Germany in the 18th century. There are 300 or something principalities, totally, well, loosely associated with something called the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, but it was just a sort of confederation of people who did what they wanted. And occasionally they'd unify when they needed to and come up with some common policies, but it didn't mean anything. You had individual feudal monarchical states in, you know, the size of, you know, Chicago. You know, the whole area of Chicago would be a whole state, or even smaller than that, right? And they're all defending their rights to govern, these little monarchs are, and if you were going to cross his bridge and his land, you'd have to pay him taxes. And there is no single unified state at all. Right? There's just what Orlo calls a geographical notion of German lands. Okay. Now, things are simplified a little bit as a result of the French Revolution and the French Revolutionary Wars, because Napoleon's got ideas. Right? He likes organizing. You know, he didn't just screw up and go to Russia. This guy, you know, had a picture. He had a plan. And he wanted to sort things out all over Europe. And what he did was to restructure German principalities so you had 30. He got it down from 300 to 30, right, as a result of his invasion and control of German lands. Okay, so that sort of simplifies things a little bit, but after the French Revolution and what they called, the Germans called, the Wars of Liberation, the Germans rise up against Napoleon, and they have to unify and they have to try to work together in order to get Napoleon out of there. They don't do it, you know, perfectly. It isn't a totally successful unification, and it doesn't stick. But they get a taste of what's going to be necessary to be a nation that can stand up for itself against France and against Russia and against England and so on. So they get a taste of that and they know they want it. Well, now you have the question, what's Germany? Where is it? Right? Is it just these states? But this state doesn't want to be part of that state. Austria has these interests in the Balkans, right? Prussia's way over there toward Russia. Okay, of course, Poland's just getting devastated by these issues all the time, and you've got Germans over here, and in and out, right? It's a mess. Alsace and Lorraine, is that part of Germany? Right. So if you think about it, you can cut this up, because it was all those little principalities for so long, in, you know, thousands of different ways, and try to identify it. And what they start to do with, after the French Revolutionary Wars is say, it's culture, it's language, it's spirit, it's blood. That's how we define it. Okay, and that's how we can, this is our identity. That's where that language comes from. They're trying to come up with a way of articulating what is German, and if you do it that way, then you have this definition of Germany that encroaches on a lot of borders, that goes all the way from Russia into territories that are French, right, and up there into maybe kind of into Dutch and Holland, and all the way down into the Balkans. That's the big German plan. Anything less than that is not going to satisfy some and is going to be referred to as a small German option. Like these Silesians will probably say, well, that's a small German option because you didn't include Silesia, right? But the big divide through the beginning of the 19th century up until 1871 is between Prussia and its sphere of influence, Bavaria and its sphere of influence, those are the biggies, and then Austria and its sphere of influence. The real problem is, how are we going to put this together and get these three behemoths to cooperate? Okay. And this is what Bismarck solves. He resolves it by going with the small German option. And what he does is he cuts Austria out of the picture and just sort of bowls over Bavaria and gets them to ally with him. Okay, so that's why Austria is a separate, you know, nation to this day. Austria has its interests down there in the Balkans. It has its own, you know, long-standing political identity. It has its Kaiser and its empire. He says, you know, we're going to have to do it without them. It's going to be a Prussian-led Germany. Okay, and he does this by first getting the Austrians to work with him and get everybody else on his side in a war against Denmark. Nobody really understands that war, but this is the first step, right? Then he actually manipulates a war against Austria. Prussia fights Austria, goes down and kicks Austria's butt, right? Men are killed. Germans are killing Germans, we would say. Prussians are killing Austrians, and he puts Austria aside, okay? Then he manipulates, he says he's just following the hem of history, but he manipulates a war against France and gets all the other German nations to side with him. And when they win, he says, hey, this really worked. Let's put it together and pay homage to the Prussian king as our unified imperial leader. And they do that in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles in France after having defeated the French in the Franco-Prussian War. The German state is established in French territory in Versailles. And that establishes this Prussian-dominated small German option, okay? Because it doesn't include Austria and other territories. And Bismarck says, well, you know, I don't care. I'm going to cut the deal and get it done, kind of like Kohl did for Silesia, right? That's how Bismarck brought this about, right? So even when Germany is unified in 1870-71 through that process, you know, it's left a lot of questions out there. It's left a lot of questions as to what this really is. And as we're going to see, some people don't see that as the right answer. It doesn't include all of Germans and so forth. So that's on the geopolitical level, okay? The other thing to keep in mind is how many variations there are on what Germany should be. You just can't lump together Germany, geographically, even culturally, because if you go to the Goethe Institute and study good high German that you need at the university to read the newspapers, and then go outside into the street and try to speak people who are speaking Bayerisch, you might as well be in Turkey. You can't understand a word they're saying unless you really can't. You cannot understand Bayerisch at all. Right, and if you go, then you take your nice German and you go over to, you know, Köln, and they're speaking Kölnisch, and you don't know what the hell they're saying there. And you go up to Berlin, you can have a polite conversation with someone, and then they'll turn to their friend and they go, and you go, what the hell is that? That's you know, slang, Berlin slang, right? So they all have these very strong dialects. It's more than just going down to South and hear them speak like, hey, that guy speaks, right? Even though he's from Connecticut. It's much stronger than that. I mean, these dialects are very strong. And the same is true in France. The same is true in France, if you've gone there. But so in a geographical sense and in a cultural sense, it's divided, right? But then there's the political and the cultural views of what Germany should be. And I'll just say, you know, generally, there's the conservative, reactionary, traditionalist orientation that feels like there should be some sort of a centralized authority, and we should be governed under that, and the German spirit needs that kind of guidance, and that's what we all say when we say, Germans love authority, and they love authority figures, and they love all of that. It's sort of a cliche, okay? Which, you know, comes out of, did you guys ever watch Hogan's Heroes? there was a comedy show on TV when I was a kid called Hogan's Heroes, which was based in a German prisoner camp. Is this complete news to most of you? Anybody heard of it before? If you can get it, I mean, you have SS guys walking around and they're funny. You know, I don't know how they got away with it. I really don't. I lost it with Hogan's Heroes. So there's the authoritarian, okay? But then there's a very strong progressive tradition. There's Marx, right? There's Engels. There's Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, the greatest thinkers of leftist thought that there ever were, right? Lenin's match, Lenin's collaborators and debaters and so on. And those 1848ers who ended up having to leave the country and come here, right? That's just two, right? The leftist versus the right wingers, and many, many variations in between politically. And then culturally, there's cultural conservatism. We like this folk. We want to connect with the peasants. We want to connect with the land. We want to connect with the soul somehow that way, this national soul. So we invoke the Middle Ages, and we invoke knights in shining armor, and we invoke the mountains, and so on and so forth. There's all of that. But then there are those who say, no, we need to be modern. We need to be progressive. We need to be like the French, right? We need neoclassicism, and just like the French have, and rationalism, and democracy, and a modern economy, and so on, right? And freedom and equality as much as is possible, right? So you have all these varieties within the German, the notion of what Germany is. And you have to take into account, because all of these flags symbolize those tensions, right? And they're trying to, I mean, each of these involves the imposition of one of those views on the situation, right? But you have to be aware of those tensions that are within. It's always problematic as to what Germans are going to accept. Which